Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, Kiel Bergen is an entrepreneur and activist who helps women empower themselves and recover from patterns of behavior that hold them back. She's the founder of B Tribes, where she helps women find independence and voice, something she learned in her own life, as she recounts in her memoir, Holy Unraveled. Born in a Catholic-aligned cult where her father was a leader, it was a childhood where arranged marriages were the norm and women were denied the right to work, how to dress, or act. Though in an incredibly abusive father and a teenage rape, Enkeel grew up to a life of drugs, eating disorder, and homelessness. Ironically, though, the religion that she blamed for breaking her helped find her life, the Madonna House in remote northern Canada. She recounts the story in her memoir and for us today here on Studio Tulsa. Kiel Bergen, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
The episodes occurred that you write about in Holy Unraveled. You've built what seems to be a fairly interesting, engaging, and fulfilling life. What compelled you to go back and tell these stories that you write about in your memoir?
I have, and it took a lot of work to build a fulfilling life like this, especially having gone through the trauma I went through. For me, I had to go back because I started to write these things, some of them in poetry form, some of the events I would just write down and throw them in a box and kind of wish them away. And then I started to do EMDR therapy and realized that it was really important to get them out. And once I went through a certain level of healing, I realized that I needed to get them out so that other people would tell their stories, especially the ones they don't want to say out loud, because that's where the healing starts to happen.
As you began going back through these episodes, I mean, obviously a lot of these episodes, they've never left you, but can you maybe talk about the task of rediscovering and putting these stories on paper?
Yes. First of all, it's excruciating to go back, back in time. And I knew, for me, if I was really going to do this and do it fully, I had to immerse myself in whatever it was I was writing. So for me, in order to do that, for example, I would, whatever the scene was, whoever was in that scene, if there was a traumatic scene or abuse, I would print that picture of that person and tape it to my screen. And that's how I had to relive it so deeply so that I could actually really let it go. And It was simply awful, but when it was over, I felt this liberation. I felt like I finally released the shame. Like, this was not my fault. This was misplaced on me. And the guilt actually belonged to the person who was either doing the abuse or insinuating that trauma. So that's how I had to do it. And I do work around the globe for empowering women in Guatemala and Vietnam, Cambodia. And I had been hearing their stories of trauma and tragedy, and I thought, you know, it's not fair. I'm asking them to tell their story. I need to tell my story.
And that story was a suburban upbringing, relatively comfortable, but your father was a part of a Catholic Church organization that was, I guess, a charismatic, almost a cult-like existence called the Disciples of Light. Can you tell us a little bit about that organization?
Sure. I was raised in it. My dad was one of the founders and one of the leaders. He was head of the Shore District. And basically, it was inside the Catholic Church, but ended up being excommunicated from the church because of their practices. And then they regrouped, I think, for 10 years and then restarted. I don't know what their practices are now. But when I was in it, it was a lot about male-dominated leadership. There were no women in leadership roles. The women were told what to wear. And, you know, I remember my mom was beautiful. And I remember little by little, the color kind of dripping away from her. Like, at first she wasn't allowed to do highlighter hair anymore. And then she wasn't allowed to wear eyeshadow. And then I remember the last of the color dripping from her face when she couldn't wear lipstick anymore. So they were called the handmaids of the Lord, the women, and the men made all the rules.
They're expected to be home, not work, really dominated from what they could do or not do all day long.
Yes, it really was like that. They definitely didn't work outside the house. And, you know, the more babies, the better, which I'm all for big families if that's what you want. But it was more highly suggested how many children you should have.
Yeah. And the life you described growing up was pretty rough because you, as you recall, you were the resistant one. Your siblings basically gave in to avoid confrontations with your father. And your father was abusive, mercurial, good-hearted, and, you know, ever-changing within a few moments, it seemed like.
Yeah, I never really knew what I was going to get. So I was on alert from a very early age because the dynamics in the family were changing based on his mood. I mean, I guess, you know, you take, for me, I've taken trauma and tried to turn it into as much beauty as I can. So that would be, for me, of being service to other people as, who have had trauma and things like that. But one of the things it did give me is an acute sense of intuition and feeling and sensing the room, you know, sensing, uh-oh, there might be trouble here. And I would try to get away as much as I could. And sometimes I just couldn't.
One of the first incidences you write about in the book was you were with a friend and you bought a pair of red jeans. And you came home and immediately, although the father wasn't home, there was immediate repercussions of what the father was going, your father was going to react to this. And in fact, it brought on a beating, but other things might not bring on a beating at all. It was just, your description was just very frightening of what it must have been like as a child to never know how your father was going to react.
Yes, I never knew. I would make up stories, you know, we're going to be fine today. We're going to be fine. And then when things went bad, sometimes I would just have to go into kind of a denial place. I used to call it my somewhere else place, like I'm just pretending I'm somewhere else. But I would sometimes, you know, run and hide too. I would hide under the boardwalk across the street from my house. And one of the things I loved to do was to listen to the people walking above me. And I would pretend I was part of their family so that I could feel some semblance of safety. And that's how I would get it.
Well, there are many unnerving episodes. One involved you shared enjoyment of horsemanship with your father. And at some point when he was upset with you, I think their sister had thrown a party in the barn in your teenage years, and you'd been grooming this thoroughbred. He basically had you get on the horse before the horse was ready to take a rider and basically set you off. Another incident while you were on vacation was, and I'm still trying to get my head around this, was he took you out to an island over some issue in a storm while you were houseboating on Lake Powell in Arizona. Somebody didn't throw the anchor down. He took you to an island and basically pointed a gun at you and shot rounds off near your head. I cannot believe this.
It was terrifying. I was about 12 years old. We were, as you say, on Lake Powell, and it was just a mood he was in because someone the night before didn't throw the anchor down. Him, you know, he was responsible to throw the anchor. And so he said, he hit me really hard off the boat the next morning and then said, I'm going to take you out and kill you. So we walked for hours and without water, and he kept threatening me. And then finally we got to the top of the hill and he pointed the gun at my head and asked if I had anything else to say. And then he shot the gun over my head. And it was terrifying. I do want to say that this book, Holy Unraveled, is fundamentally, it's about healing. And it's about radical transformation that you can make in your life. And it's about resiliency. And it's the things that we all have. We all have that ability to heal and ability to move through trauma and abuse. And yes, there is a lot of abuse in the story because it's my memoir, but I really wrote it so that people could say, if she can heal, I can heal too.
And of course, the irony of that was that here you are growing up in this cult associated with the Catholic Church, the Disciples of Light. It's another Catholic group that helps give you that healing, the Madonna House.
Right. The irony is fantastic, right? Yes. So there's basically three segments of the book, the childhood with the trauma and abuse. The second section is really when I left the family and the cult. I could not self-regulate. I was chasing adrenaline. I didn't know how to. I was like looking for a boundary because there was no one to tell me what to do. And so I made a ton of bad choices. Then I became kind of destitute. And then I ended up going to a lay apostolate Catholic, beautiful community, rural Ontario, Canada, about 5 hours north of Toronto. I lived there with those people, 150 people. We lived off the land. I sheared sheep and milked cows and stuck my hand down chicken gullets and got the eggs out. And I mean, it was an intense way of living, and I did it. Worked in silence. And I'm actually writing a piece right now called "The Price and the Power of Silence," because there's such a price that I paid for being told I have no voice when I was young. I mean, my dad used to say to us, anyone under 30 is not allowed to talk for 24 hours. And that was devastating for a young girl who felt like she had a lot to say. But then there's this power that there is to silence, because I spent a year in that community and they embraced me with so much love. And yes, there was structure and it was Catholic, and but really it was about love. And I'm not Catholic anymore, but that place healed me, and the silence, going inside and being silent, healed me and helped me understand myself.
Well, I have to ask questions I had as I was reading the book. You know, in the early part of the book, when you're describing this upbringing, you have a large family, and the family dynamic, everyone reacts in their own way to this abusive relationship. But one strength of power at the time seemed to be to protect a younger sister named Rachel. Mm-hmm. And you know, as the book goes on, you break ties with that family. And I guess as a reader, I was wanting to know what happened to the rest of the family. I assume right. You've broken ties with them, and those ties have been broken permanently?
They have been broken permanently. I did stay in touch with them for a long time. I was actually the maid of honor in Rachel's wedding. So we had an okay relationship. I got to the point where, for me, I couldn't be myself, my authentic self, inside of that family, because I had decided to leave the Catholic Church, and that was not okay with them. So Rachel ended up leaving me a voicemail saying, the fact that you're leaving the church means that we won't be in heaven together, and so I can't be in your life. And so it's really, really, it will be the saddest thing of my life that I've lost my family of origin, but it's also the only way I could be who I'm supposed to be in the world. And so I've created my own family, my chosen family, my three boys that are amazing, and then a chosen family. I've raised my kids with who I call my sisters, you know, that we've been friends for 25, 26, 28 years, and we do all our holidays together. And so I've really created a extremely healthy, yummy environment for my kids and for myself to grow up in.
Is your birth family still immersed in that religious community?
As far as I know, yes. Not that particular community, because that was in a different state, but they are all involved in their own forms of Catholicism that are, you know, deep.
Right. Deep and perhaps exclusionary to those who are outside of it.
I believe so, but I can't speak for them. I can only speak for myself, but that's my understanding.
My guest today is Kiel Bergen. She's an entrepreneur, a writer, a woman's empowerment activist, and the author of Holy Unraveled, a memoir, which is a memoir in three sections of her growing up within this Catholic cult, her escape, and really her inability to cope outside of that order as she's finding her own independence, and then finally a scene of healing and redemption, again in another Catholic order, the Madonna House, which she writes about in the third section of the book. Earlier in our conversation, you said as you were beginning to tell this story, you said you went through a therapy called EMDR, which I'm not really familiar with. How did this help you, and what is it, and how did it help you?
Thank you for bringing that up, because I believe so wholeheartedly in how it helped me. I've been doing the therapy for more than a dozen years with the same therapist. So grateful for it. So it's called EMDR. It stands for Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing. It's basically an interactive psychotherapy where it uses the left and the right brain. And I'm not a scientist, and I'm just so grateful it works. I'm not even too concerned how, because it works. But it's basically for abuse and for trauma, and it helps to kind of reprogram how you think about it. So I know that those things happened to me, but when I talk about them now, I don't have a trauma response to them.
And so eye movement, can you explain why that's in the title? I'm sure. Still trying to understand it.
Yeah, there are different ways that people do it, but basically it's left to right brain. So some people will hold paddles that vibrate left, right, left, right. For me, it was the eye movement. So my therapist would hold kind of a wand and go back and forth, and I'd follow it with my eyes, left, right, left, right. And we would bring up a certain memory or a feeling, and it was as if it was like an accordion. All of a sudden, it was boom, 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 and there were like 20 things that I could remember happening and based on one memory. And that's really how I started to remember a lot of my childhood, is going through this EMDR. And you basically do this left and right with the wand or the paddles until you don't have that reaction to that memory anymore. So I wouldn't say it's reliving it, but you know it's happening. It's almost like reprocessing it to a place where it's not so traumatic.
Let me ask you about some of the memories that you recount in the first section of the book. Had they been repressed at any point in the, you know, as you left home and you were living on your own, when you sought refuge at the Madonna House or later in life?
I don't think they were repressed, but some of them were, I would say they were below the surface all the time, because I lived in fear for decades until I finally started coming out and telling my story and using my voice and doing this EMDR. So they were always there, but as I did the EMDR, they became, I could remember dialogue. I could remember exactly what color that wall was. So the memories became more distinct as I did the work.
As opposed to a memory that basically caused an adrenaline push or, you know, a nightmare or something like that, or some manifestation of a general feeling of dread.
Right. I had the general feelings of dread as well. I'd wake up with nightmares. I always slept with my hands and fists, and I don't do that anymore, thank goodness. But but it was kind of both. I lived in a trauma state for a long time.
Yeah. In the second section of the book, you discuss in detail some of the bad decisions you made. But I was struck by something you said. You said, you know, I was in a way sort of addicted to the adrenaline of these negative experiences. Mm-hmm. Do you think that was really the case?
I think that's a great question. I think I was trying to find a way out. I'm not chasing this adrenaline to say, I don't think I'm worthy enough to be on the planet. Mm. I didn't believe I was worthy enough to be alive. And I can say that out loud now, and I want to say it out loud so that people who are feeling that today can say, I can just say to them, you are so worthy. You are so worthy to be here. And it's not an easy fight to get through this, but it's worth it when you get to the other side, because I see my worth now.
Tell us about the decision to go north to Canada. I know at some point you were in the Midwest. You'd gone to college in Nebraska. This is where this episode began, the second episode of your life. What was the provoking experience that said, I have to go to this place up in northern Canada and find something?
Yes. So I was basically, I had overdosed on a drug. I don't know what it was, because I was in a limo with a bunch of drug dealers and it was just being passed out, which is horrifying to say out loud, but it's true. And I basically had taken too much and I was on the ground, and I just remember people kind of dancing on me and their drinks were spilling on me, and I thought, this is it. Like, this is how I'm going to die. And the limo driver must have been counting heads or something, because he pulled me out and gave me mouth to mouth. And I woke up on that grass, and my so-called friends left, and I had no idea where my car was. I had been evicted from another apartment, so I had nowhere to go. And it was like as close as I can get to a spiritual experience. I remember hearing this priest. His name is Archbishop Joseph Raya. I'm so grateful for him. I heard his voice in my head. He was a priest that I had met when I was young. He had come to our home. He'd come to live in New Jersey for a summer. And he would take me for walks on the boardwalk. He knew my dad and my mom. He would take me for walks on the boardwalk, and he would really talk to me. And he was actually interested in what I had to say. And he would ask me questions, and he would talk about Marilyn Monroe. And he gave me my first communion when he wasn't supposed to. And he was from the Byzantine Rite. And he was so effervescent. And I just remembered him. And I remember him saying to me, all there is love. Like love, this word love. And when I came to that morning in the grass, I thought, I could believe maybe in that, maybe. And so I hitchhiked to Madonna House up northern Ontario, Canada from there. A very nice man. One of them who picked me up, an older gentleman, finally bought me a bus ticket and got me all the way there. And that's how I got to Madonna House, because he lived there for the summers.
And in the book, you describe that, you know, this rebelliousness that had been a part of your life was still very much evident at the beginning, yet you stuck it out.
Well, yeah, I didn't really have anywhere else to go, number one. Number two, as you read the book, you know that I stayed for 2 weeks, but then the silence. I talked about earlier about the price and the power of silence. Well, first, when I got silent, it was the scariest thing in the world, because I didn't have anything to fill that pain or that those thoughts, and they all just were coming and coming and coming, and I didn't know what to do with them. So after 2 weeks, I ended up, not proud of this, but I ended up stealing a car, and I left Madonna House because I thought, I got to get out of here. Like, this is ridiculous. And so I stole a car, and I went to upstate New York, and I remember sitting, I was by the water, which is always my respite, and I remember sitting there and thinking, I will go back to those old ways if I don't go back to Madonna House and truly do the work to heal. And so I drove that car back. I did a huge mea culpa. Please let me stay. And thank goodness that my favorite virtue is grace, and they showed grace and let me stay.
It sounds like from your description that a major turning point occurred when another member that was there had this horrible episode. She had been working at Madonna House for some time and basically giving her life in service of this mission and this religious order. And she had a terrible traumatic event among her family. And she sort of had this cathartic moment. And that was actually, seemed like it was a helpful breakthrough for you as well.
Oh my gosh. That was my moment. So she stood up, and after this horrible thing happened to her brother, she stood up and said, I hate God. And I thought, uh-oh, like the roof's going to come in. You know, the God I was taught about, which was really what I came to, was that was really my dad. You know, my dad acted as God. But yes. Here she was dancing with the divine and saying, I'm angry at you. And I thought, are you allowed to do that and not be hurt? But you know what? God is merciful. Like God gets it. There's all kinds of human emotions. And if she wasn't angry about what happened to her brother, something's wrong. And so it gave me a freedom. It let me, I think I said it something like, she had this red hot holy power, you know? And she was dancing with the divine and saying, not fair. Because you know what? Life isn't fair. And that was my moment where I thought, okay, if God can handle that, then I can believe in that God. That God can be merciful and graceful and loving and kind, and also bad things happen.
Well, today you're working in a lot of different areas, but one of them is as an activist for women's empowerment movement, working in a variety of countries, providing microcredit, doing lots of work. What is the satisfaction of that work today, given your own history?
Oh, great. I love that work. I've spent about 25 years on several different boards doing work with empowering women. And I know in my heart of hearts that when a woman finds and uses her voice, she can absolutely change the world around her. And so I've done that in other countries for 25 years. And then about a little over a year ago, I thought, I need to do it here. There's abuse and trauma, and people need healing here. And so I started a business called Bee Tribes. And it's based on Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. And I have a fundamental belief that once we can relinquish the patterns that don't serve us in our life anymore, we can architect a life we're meant to live. And so that's what I do, is I curate groups of 12 women and bring them together as a tribe. And I take them through this beautiful curriculum of empowerment and taking back ownership of your life. And they have been, it's been such a gift to watch, because I believe that we are all the teacher and we are all the student. And we have so much to give each other and so much that we can absorb from each other, from other people's experience and strength and hope, and so much that we can give of our own. And so to watch these groups, these tribes come together and go through their 6 months has been such a gift.
My guest today is Kiel Bergen. Her new memoir is titled Wholly Unraveled. In the process of writing this story, what have you learned about yourself in writing this story down, that your life story, that you've internalized, dealt with over the years? But what did you learn from actually writing this book?
I learned that if I am one thing, I am resilient. And I didn't really know that before. I thought things were just happening to me. But when I went back, I realized, you know, I looked my dad in the eye as he was threatening to kill me. I tried to get out before I was able to when I was 18. I was trying really hard all along to have a great life. And what I learned was I really am those. I write about an essence statement in the book. And what I learned about myself is I really was and am all those words. And for me, that is, I am Kiel. I am worthy, powerful, connected, and sensual, experiencing life with abundance, laughter, and vulnerability. And it just took me so long to step into those words. But I learned that that's what I came into this world with. And no one could take it away. They tried and they tried and they tried. But our light can shine brighter.
Kiel Bergen, thanks very much for joining us.
I appreciate being here. Thank you, Rich.
Kiel Bergen is an entrepreneur, a writer, and a women's empowerment activist, and the author of her memoir, Wholly Unraveled. It's published by Little A Publishers. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our programs, you can listen online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org or just go to studiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.